Welcome to Vancouver True Crime. I'm with a very honored guest, Seb Lavoie, who was a police officer, the RCMP, for over 20 years. He retired in 2021 as a divisional sergeant major for E Division in British Columbia. His career revolved around RCMP specialized in elite units, a flight safety officer, also known as an air marshal, before moving on as a full-time member of the BC Lower Mainland Emergency Response Team. He was both a breacher and a team leader. In this conversation, we're going to talk about situational awareness, his career as an RCMP officer, polarizing politics of the city of Vancouver. Is the city more violent? Is it perception? Philosophy on mindset, his background in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. He's currently a black belt, travels around as a motivational speaker, and many more things. So let's please introduce him. Thank you for coming to Vancouver True Crime.
Hey, man. Thanks for having me.
I really appreciate you coming on. The rank that you reached before you retired, and kind of what does that rank mean?
I'm not sure it means a lot. Theoretically speaking, my career was based upon not caring about rank so much and wanting to do the things that I wanted to do. So if the job that I wanted was associated with a rank, then all the better. But if it wasn't, then it wouldn't stop me from doing it. And inversely, I would never have taken a job that I didn't want to do on account of getting a promotion. And so this was, a rule that I lived by during my career. And it certainly worked out its magic, because I ended up 3 ranks higher than I ever wanted to, and doing jobs that were very important jobs on the on account of the collective, so to speak. So, this was an opportunity that was given to me when I was still a team leader on the team, on the emergency response team, and I was approached by the then CO or commanding officer of the division here in British Columbia, Brenda Butterworth Carr, who moved on to become the director of policing in British Columbia at the province level a few months after I took office, really. But she approached me, and for a reason that remains a bit of a mystery to me, she had made up her mind that I was the right person to come over and bridge the gap between the executive officers and the rank and file, so people of other ranks such as constable, corporal, sergeant, etc. And so I, was on the tail end of my ERT careers. I, if I'm being honest, after 12 years on the team, I was starting to consider that perhaps it was time to move on, even though I had no particular plan of doing so. But after the offer, it took me about 8 weeks to make up my mind and finally leave the place that I'd worked so hard to be at. And that was my sole purpose for coming in the outfit in the first place, which was the emergency response team. But I was provided this golden opportunity, and I felt like I could make a change, and I did just that and joined the commanding officer's office as a sergeant major for the division, and I spent 2 years in that role.
Maybe talk about for the emergency response team, and maybe break that down for someone who's never heard of it, or maybe only seen it on television shows and Hollywood and Netflix. What's that like? Is that a kind of an accurate perception of what you see on Hollywood?
Yeah, no, it's nothing like Hollywood. I mean, some of it, obviously, sometimes reality can exceed fiction, but the reality is the way tactical teams are portrayed in the Hollywood sort of context is almost always incredibly stupid and skewed.
So
this is my opinion on that, but essentially our task is to respond to calls for service that are beyond the capacity of patrol officers, and this is not doesn't mean to be derogatory in nature, but we're talking by way of training and equipment. And so it is an elite unit that uses those tools and those tactics, techniques, and procedures, as well as the equipment, as well as the training, to problem solve issues, critical issues, I might I might want to say, and prevent an escalation of violence, whatever that is. So sometimes, yes, we may be escalating violence in order to de-escalate a situation. Everything is done in a controlled fashion. Everything is done with a articulated rationale, and everything is done under the tutelage and the oversight of a critical incident command group, which is generally comprised of negotiators, psychologists, bomb squads and dog squads and variety of different units that can provide insight that helps us problem solve effectively. That in addition to the emergency response team ground TLs and the element leads on the ground that can provide direct input from where the wheels meet the pavement, and then we can formulate plans of action based on the totality of the circumstances. That is, in a nutshell, what this looks like.
As time went on in that, like, because again, I just imagine the amount of training for the different types of scenarios, and then, you know, there's a lot of variety of situations that can happen. Like even our last conversation, we talked about, you know, like say a domestic violence situation that gets out of control, you know, guy's drunk and he's arguing and this gets more and more and more violent, or really bad people with explosives and guns and they're holding someone for hostage. So you feel like the variety of training that you had to do and this the constantly, did you find that you'd almost have to kind of almost reinvent the wheel because situations are all constantly evolving, weapons are changing, you know, tactics are changing, and people, like, you know, the mental illness factor too, you know, that's always a big question mark when you're walking into a very volatile situation like that.
Yeah, as you mentioned, we treated emotionally disturbed persons or people with documented mental health issues a lot differently than we would, you know, a robber that's taken somebody hostage inside a house, and this is a criminal barricade now, right? And so, yes, there's a lot of complexities around changing even one variables on a call that changes the entire course of action or the response, but having a base framework to work from, so focusing on the things that we can control, like our training tactically, having our equipment available, having our equipment, being trained on the equipment, understanding our legal statute, their authorities, understanding what the offense is, having the right briefing format, all those things we can control. And then once we've controlled all those things, we're able to adapt and overcome whatever situation might be, regardless if it's different or exactly the same as another one. And once we're conducting a risk assessment, once we're looking at the totality of the circumstances, we're able to pick exactly where this call differs from the previous one, or from the one after, and how we are going to bridge that gap and use innovative tactics, techniques, and procedures to problem solve those calls. So yeah, it's consistently keeping you on your toes, so to speak. And it takes a lot of flexibility from an operational standpoint to be able to problem solve a variety of different dilemmas, all with different set of circumstances.
A bit personal, but the decompressing from after that, like you're just like, you know, that would take a toll over time, you know, even post-traumatic stress issues, things like that, because it's just constantly, you're thrown into almost like a meat grinder and expected to solve it. And of course, if anything goes wrong, then...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I think it's really interesting. We as a unit, and we've made our fair share of mistakes when it came to wellness and mental and emotional wellness of our operators. But over the years, we developed, you know, several key principles that we're going by, and some procedures to deal with and enable our people to not only remain healthy, but also go back to work and face another call, and then come back and then return and face another call, because the calls they don't stop coming, right? Oh. So having a way to deal with this was a critical piece. And I was semi-instrumental in developing this for this specific team, although I certainly wasn't the only one that was invested in doing so, and many of our people did that. Now, there's a lot of complexities around occupational stress injuries, PTSD, who gets it, who doesn't, who it affects. And to a certain extent, the job affects everybody to a certain extent. and it just varies in scope, you know, like how impacted is someone versus somebody else. And it all depends on individual factors such as resiliency, you know, adversity ridden life or not, you know, selection, all those things. But in the context of a tactical unit like the one I was on, because by way of selection and by way of testing, by way of everything, we were able to mitigate perhaps some of the effects or the after effects of tactical operations. We weren't able to eliminate them, but certainly mitigate is as good as it's going to get. And ultimately, at the end of the day, there is a sacrifice associated with service, right? And that's a big part of it. So trying to mitigate it and trying to keep it as manageable as humanly possible, mostly through leadership, and the rest of it is kind of out of our hands, so to speak, right?
Breacher, maybe explain to the audience what does that mean?
Yeah, I spent I want to say 5 years as a breacher, which is the person that gained an entry to the stronghold. So that's the person that is responsible for getting the team from outside a building or a house or a garage or whatever the case may be into inside, and do so in a timely fashion and in a safe manner, so that they may go in and problem solve whatever issues is occurring inside. Because we can have the best team in the world on the outside, but if we can't get them inside where the problem is, then we're having bigger problems, right? So my job was essentially to use either mechanical means or ballistic means or explosive means to get inside a building so that the team could go problem solve issues.
Side of the door waiting for you. That would be pretty intense, I can imagine. My question is that if you ever get into a situation where it's like, say, the door is completely barricaded, and that is the reaction they wanted. This is their big moment, or you know.
Yeah, I mean, yes, I've encountered plenty of barricades. I've encountered plenty of people wanting a negative interaction with oodles of people that decided afterwards they really didn't want an interaction with police once they got the team to deal with certain things. But those are, you know, humans are complex creatures, man. People do things for various reasons, and it's not always logical and it's not always commonsensical as far as everybody else is concerned.
No, there's another podcast I listened to. He's quite a fascinating character. His podcast is called Ed Manifesto. He was a cop in Mexico. And he talks a lot about intention. There's nothing you can do, and there's no training. There's nothing you can, as far as someone's intention. You know, someone's intentions are so crazy and beyond yours that there's no preparation to prepare for it. And I think that's what makes situations so volatile, because it's like, okay, what are their intentions? Are they just so crazy that they don't know what they're doing? Or is this the thing that they've been planning for a long time, right? How mentally do you prepare yourself for that? And how do you balance that? I guess there must be an important, you know, they talk about work-life balance.
Yeah, I don't know if I would describe my 12 years on the team as balanced. To make it to a unit like this, you need a certain level of obsession, right? Like you need to be obsessed to a certain degree. And yes, work-life balance is an important part of this once you are active on a team. But also, I think understanding that the team is the last line of defense. And so at the end of the day, you know, there are going to be sacrifices that are going to occur, such as, you know, leaving birthdays and Christmas and whatever, because you get called out on these calls, and sometimes leaving for extended period of times, do all this stuff. So, but I would say that what makes this easier is as it stands right now, there's a lot of people that don't have much of a work-life balance, but they're also working in a miserable job that they absolutely hate, right? Whereas it's generally speaking, on the teams, the boys just love what they're doing, and our people love what they're doing. And when you love what you're doing, easier to maintain the perspective. It's easier to maintain a certain level of health and wellness. It's easier to look at things from a purpose standpoint, which gives you a lot of tools You know, if what you are doing feels purposeful and meaningful, it does a lot to alleviate some of the issues and some of the stressors associated with this type of work. So for me personally, I never really was an overly emotional person in the context of my work. And I also never sort of strived for perfection in the sense that I understood the limitations from an emotional, from a mental and emotional standpoint, the limitations that, you know, human beings are on an individual basis, on an individual basis, what my own limitations were and what some of the limitations of the people working for me were, and understanding and knowing your people and caring for them really helps with that. And so we had, you know, systems and subsystems and pillars in place to help them ground themselves outside of the work capacity. And that often is what's missing and what's lacking. When the job starts defining you and it defines everything you stand for, anything that happens that interferes with the smooth operation of that creates issues. And so we were trying to alleviate this as much as we could. And that was one way that we had to manage the stress associated with the job.
So for someone like yourself, you're on one end of the spectrum, you know, personal responsibility, you're athletic, you work out a lot, you're in training, you know, you've been on these very elite teams. And then on the other end of the spectrum where we find ourselves and we have kind of a culture of victimization. Everyone's a victim, professional victims, and then almost an industry of enabling these people. And then, of course, this has created a massive social problem. There has been this new kind of movement, and I, you know, even myself, I've had some bizarre run-ins with them on my platform, the ACAB people, and they seem to have the ear of like politicians, you know, doing cuts, you know, budget cuts, and they kind of want to paint a picture that all of society's problems is because we have costs, but yet they don't have a solution of how you replace that. So here's a person like yourself who's been on probably some pretty scary, violent calls that the average person would even comprehend it. And then there's someone on the other side screaming that, you know, your job shouldn't exist. So what's your thoughts on like this political polarizing environment that we find ourselves in?
Yeah, well, I think it's a small minority who's really, really loud. I don't believe at all that that's a majority of people. So the majority of people are very supportive of law enforcement and supportive of us. They're the quiet majority, so to speak. And then you have your super loud minority, which, you know, when you call your movement ACAB or whatever you want to call it, you, as far as I'm concerned, you've already discredited your intent. You've already discredited your thought process, and you've definitely negated your critical analysis capacity. I'm not even concerned with those types of groups, you know, sometimes an academic utopian way of dealing with things. Sometimes they don't even have the academic behind them. So they're even worse. They're just in utopia, but they actually don't have an education to back it up. So from a leadership standpoint, it's clear and evident that we as a country are failing, and it's not just us, it's the United States as well and others. Sure. We're failing in the leadership department to establish what the reality is and what the root causes of some of the issues are. But look at the states that have defunded the police right now, like New York City, Chicago. The murder rates are up like 200-something%. It's just completely insane what's going on over there right now. And in fact, a lot of the politicians that were pushing the defund the police agenda, and they're actually in the opposite direction and asking for additional support so that they may the stats in their own state with respect to violent crimes and so on. So now what we're seeing is, oh, we want to go that way 100%. Oh, wait, this doesn't work. It just backfired on us. So let's go the complete opposite way. All along, I could have told you exactly what was going to happen with this. If anything, the police forces needed more money, more training, more, call it whatever you want. But if you're taking it away and they're still out there doing the job, how can this come across as a good idea? How does this come across commonsensical? Because it certainly isn't. And it was always doomed to fail. And we're continuing to, here in the country, in Canada, if we're to compare with the States, our stats are not nearly as sort of catastrophic as they are in the States. So one could look here and say, how do you actually quantify what isn't and what didn't happen, because that's a very difficult part of policing, is to try to prove what you prevented. Because most of your job, and if you're doing it correctly, things are not happening, right?
Oh.
And so it's very difficult. You have your ambush type scenarios where things are happening and would happen anyways, and then you have your the other side of the spectrum where if you have prevented a whole bunch of things, then you can no longer prove that those things would have interfered with everybody's well-being, right? And so it's really difficult to quantify what isn't, and it's extremely difficult to keep track of what is.
Yeah, and also, too, on top of it, I truly believe that we live in a more dangerous, volatile society currently, you know, like the random, we talked before, random violence, you know, people who are mentally ill, probably on hard drugs and in a state of psychosis, attacking people, right? That seems to be on the rise, especially in the downtown. In my opinion, I really believe that the courts and the judges have a responsibility in this, because they just seem to let them out and let them out and let them out. The guy that smashed up the TD Bank, I saw is yesterday. Oh, he's back out again. He's probably guessing that must be frustration. You take a bad person off the street just to have them released again. You know, that machete attacker, you know, attacked some tourists. And back out on the street, can't find him, police issue a bulletin, you know, please keep your eye out for him, right? I think they arrested him again. But, you know, in my opinion, a person willing to wave around a machete and actually use it, a term, a menace to society, right? It seems like the courts are never really accountable of why they make a decision or don't make a decision. And, of course, in a lot of the cases that I've researched and talked about and did on the podcast, I talk about the Crown prosecutor staying charges. And to Americans, that doesn't make any sense to them. Well, you know, we mean they stayed the charge. They don't even know what that means. And I explain that a lot. So I think our system is very different, and it doesn't really... I don't think it helps the situation either. If there's an uptick in violence, you'd think that they would be more proactive of trying to mitigate it, but they treat it very differently. I guess that's a different conversation, but I'd be interested in what your thoughts are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the system itself needs an overhaul, right? It needs an overhaul. It just does. I mean, there's so many interrelated and interconnected pieces that need to work together, and those pieces need to be pulling in the same direction. As it stands right now, we're absolutely not doing that. And the reason why we're successful in not doing that is because there isn't as much happening that makes us pay for our faulty behavior, so to speak, right? Mm-hmm. And so I'll give you an example of this and try to exemplify this a little bit more concretely. But if you're looking at 9/11, for example, if you're looking at 9/11 and the way the agencies were not communicating with each other, they were building, you know, empires, they had different communication systems, they worked on different radios, they had different shift schedules, they, you know, and everybody was concerned with, you know, problem solving their own set of issues and not necessarily interacting with others or using others in the pursuit of doing that, or whatever the case may be, until the planes hit.
Right.
And when the planes hit New York and Pennsylvania and all this good stuff during 9/11, it forced everybody to work together better, more seamlessly, more synergetically. And it forced everybody to look and overall their processes so that they may be integrating other people and agencies, and they realizing that there was such a duplication of work that was being a causality of some of the issues that they had. But we're no different here with respect to the criminal justice system. I mean, it starts at the legislation, right? So the legislation goes through. And if it doesn't have the teeth to give the judges and lawyers and people in the position to actually operationalize or weaponize those legislations, we're having issues. And then once decisions are made, say at the Supreme Court level or whatever, if those decisions are seemingly say in favor of bad guys or offenders rather than victims, then there has to be an extrapolation of what exactly transpired here and why was the decision that was made by the Supreme Court was made on account of. And a lot of this stuff is legal mumbo jumbo that the layperson wouldn't really understand anyways. So how can we articulate it so that the layperson can understand what this entails in a variety of different rabbit hole you can go down of, right? But at the end of the day, we definitely need to look at recidivism that we have in this country with respect to, and I think Vancouver, and in the documentary, I think Vancouver is dying. Don't they speak about, 6,000 arrests, like, or 6,000 people being responsible for 50,000 calls or something? Oh, yeah. I can't remember what the numbers were, but yeah. I mean, I've experienced it myself where we had someone when I was on patrol that we essentially was intoxicated in a public place pretty much every day, sometimes two or three times a day. And some of these guys would have 300-400 apprehension, and spend the night in jail. And that wasn't somebody that had a propensity for violence. But imagine if somebody had a propensity for violence in addition to what they're already having as a set of issues. And then you allow them to be back on the street again, re-victimizing other people. And the same can be said about or doing sexual assaults even right. more so.
Just 2 years, I've seen this just from, again, running a platform, following news and, looking at what's going on in the city. From my point of view, I've seen a real uptake in specifically in the random violence. So unprovoked attacks, right? And some of them are just horrific. Like there was one where a woman made an improvised taser and she was going around tasering people for just insane. Cases, it seems like they're also under the influence of usually a hard drug, methamphetamine or something like that. And for the people that contact me that who've been victims of it, and mostly women, their testimonies are terrifying. Told me about her neighbor. She got hit in the head from behind while walking the seawall, and she woke up in St. Paul's Hospital. Citizen more so now feels a lot less unsafe than they used to. So maybe let's break down, what you feel is one of the most important tools to possess, situational awareness, and maybe talk about what that means and how, why that's an important thing to utilize when you're out and about in public.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, situational awareness is just essentially having the awareness that, yes, that there are people out there that are wanting to do bad things to good people, and that you may be one of those good people. So yeah. You simply, it's an assumption of risk that when you leave your house and you open that door and you walk out, there's a variety of things that will expose you to potential dangers. And so you have two choices. You can put your head in the sand and pretend they don't exist and wish that you don't get caught. If you're lucky, and then we know that wish is the last thing, wish of those who believe that winning can happen by accident, or you can literally take your fate into your own hands and start looking critically at how you are conducting business, how you are doing things, how you are approaching your car, where do you park, what time do you do it at, which route do you take home, which route you go to work on, those types of things. So staying in a semi state of alertness, and I'm not talking about like being in a red state here where you're completely on high alert, right, waiting yeah. for an to come out of everywhere. But I'm talking about simply, if you're proceeding through an airport, an intersection, or whatever the case may be, are you on your phone, without looking around? Do you scan around? Do you know, generally speaking, who's standing around you, what their demeanor is like, what kind of threat they might pose if somebody approaches you? Do you have the knowledge, skills, and ability to look at their hands to make sure they cannot deliver a threat because they don't necessarily have something in their hands, or if they do, creating some distance? There's two things. There's the situational awareness piece, and then there's the associated actions that you're going to take once you realize what's going on. So understanding what's happening and what you need to be doing to sort of lessen or mitigate the risk associated with a certain event is critical in ensuring that you are safe. And that needs to be done on an individual basis. There's no question there.
Right, of course. So what if you're not necessarily you're in the situation? Like, I mean, you're more of a witness, but let's say you're like out with your spouse or friends or loved ones or whoever, and you're out, let's say, in a restaurant, pub, or somewhere a bit crowded and there's lots of people, and like a big fight breaks out, or maybe there was a video, I think I sent you a copy, it was a stabbing just before Halloween. Pretty horrific video. It was a big dude, he fought off about four or five guys, and he ended up getting stabbed, but, you know, chairs are being kicked over, tables are being kicked over. It's pretty, you know, pretty dramatic stuff, right? What would you say the best thing to do in a situation like that? If you're with a loved one, though, like, you know what I mean? Like, you're...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, there's a variety of different scenarios, right? And it all depends who you are and what your skills, knowledge, and abilities are. But I will say this, generally speaking, things just don't come out of nowhere. Generally speaking, there's a build up to those things. So I'm going to surmise that during or before the fight, in the case of the video you sent me, there has to have been an escalation sort of between, you know, the parties and something that could have been easily picked off probably if somebody was paying attention. And so for me, it starts there. Like, am I sitting next to a group that I anticipate might have some issues? Are they starting to interact adversely with another group? And if that's the case, how do I go about getting my wife, myself, and the kids moved, you know, by speaking to one of the waiter or whatever the case may be? So there are actions that you can take before it blows up. And this might include you picking up your stuff and heading out. Like, we're gonna take it to go. Like, I don't like the current situation or the climate in here. I don't like the crowd in here. I don't like what's unfolding in here, and I suspect it will escalate. Let's grab our food and head out. You know, those are all viable options. As far as I'm concerned, I have certain things that I'm not prepared to do. One of those things is I'm not prepared to let the collective, the innocent collective, sustain injuries or being hurt by somebody that's actively looking to hurt people, mm-hmm. but not in the context of a specific conflict, right? So you have two people that consensually decide to fight. That's their prerogative, man. I'm not getting involved in this unless, you know, evidently one person is now, you know, on the ground unconscious and yeah. the other one is going to kick him in the head, so to speak. But those are not the types of scenarios that I generally would get involved in unless there is an actual victim, like somebody is actually being victimized by a criminal offense. Like, for me, the priority is always to get the family out of there, and we'll have those conversations before, like, this is where the emergency exit is. This is where we can link up if something goes up. And if I'm in a restaurant and something starts escalating and we're making some moves, I might be telling the people I'm with, like, look, if something happens, this is what I'd like you to do, you know? And we generally, you know, kind of do this and have a bit of a plan, because failing to have a plan is no plan.
Yeah, for sure. I have a large female audience, so I like to give like safety tips for them as well. Women, what are good general safety tips for women that are out by themselves, you know, like just doing their thing, shopping? Because this, again, these random attacks, a lot of times it's like, you know, woman downtown shopping, guy hits her in the head with a hammer, you know, just as the worst thing you could possibly imagine, you know, things like that sort. Like, what are some of the advice would you give them?
Yeah, I mean, exactly the same as we just discussed, right? Having your wits about you, keeping your eyes open, understanding that, again, as I said earlier, that bad things happen to good people and that you are not exempt from that. You are going to have your time. Something is going to happen. It's almost guaranteed if you live in an urban center specifically. And your tools to prevent those things from happening are hinging primarily in your ability to recognize a threat before it starts. And if you don't have that, you're going to be reactive. When you are reactive, you're always behind. You can never sort of beat somebody to the punch, so to speak, if they're the initiator and you weren't prepared for whatever it is that's coming. And so, again, in the spirit of everything we just discussed, it's critically important for women and men to actually be paying attention to their surroundings, to pay attention to the environment, to pay attention to the people walking towards them, to make sure that they use physical obstacles in between them and somebody else if they can switch, you know, street side if they have to, whatever the case may be, so that they may create some distance and have more time to react to anything. And one of the critical piece that I think we need to mention is that the people that are victimizing people in random fashions like this is generally not so random. It's random in that there's no known affiliation between the victim and the person that's obviously assaulting them or doing something to them. But it's not random in the sense that the person that selected that victim picked them for a reason. And generally that reason is the perceived factors of them not having the ability to physically overpower the person that's delivering the threat or the assault, or that the risk of getting caught is very low. So right. Ability to fight back is a big thing. If the person doesn't think that you have the ability to fight back, and this could be completely erroneous, you may mistakenly fall on the person that actually doesn't look like they can fight back or are very capable, and now you're in a bad place. But generally, bullies will select their target very carefully. They will select their target so that their own safety is not jeopardized by whatever actions that they're taking. They're also use surprise and violence of action to prevent somebody from that even potentially could have the ability to defend themselves. But because they were surprised, they were ambushed. They haven't had an opportunity to do it. So they're trying to control the parameters around whatever criminal behavior they're exhibiting. And so the best way to alleviate any of that is to actually harden the target, which is a concept in which if a person is looking at you, are they going to think this is somebody I can pick on right now? They're not paying attention. They're not doing this. They're not doing that. They're completely exposed. Their back's turned to everybody. They're buried in their phone. And also they're out of shape. They don't have the ability. It looks like they don't have the ability to fight, whatever. And is there anybody around that can get me caught? If the answer is no to all of those questions, then that person is a perfect candidate. Inversely, if the person looks like they're paying attention, that they're scanning, that they're safety conscious, that potentially are in good physical condition with an ability to run, fight, or scream, or whatever, or a combination of all of those things, and is generally aware of your presence in the area and looking at you in a sort of suspicious, you know, way, like they're looking at you like knowing that you're up to no good. And then that person now has to make a choice. Am I going to take that person or the next person that actually doesn't give me any of those signs? And the answer is always the same. They will pick the person that has the less likelihood of getting him hurt or cut every single time.
Well, that makes sense. Totally. So you're a martial arts instructor. You're also a co-owner of a martial arts studio. What's the name of your studio?
Ascension Martial Arts.
And you're currently a black belt in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. For women, men who are interested in learning a martial arts, maybe tell them more why you believe Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu is a better martial arts than, say, karate or any other ones.
Well, it's not so much as better in terms of its application. It's not necessarily better on all aspects, and we've discussed this last time, but it's not necessarily better for discipline. It's not necessarily better for, you know, mental and emotional wellness, all those things. You can get a lot out of any martial arts in doing that. But I think when it comes to the wheels hitting the pavement, what we have seen, and this became quite obvious in 1993 when the UFC first started, and everybody was expecting these striking arts to be dominating, and really it was never the case, hardly ever. And it was mostly some skinny ground fighter that used, you know, leverage and angles and techniques and fulcrums and levers and to be able to overcome natural strength, power, and athleticism of an opponent, right? And so one of the biggest concern is that you're always at the mercy of somebody that has better physical gift for violence. So size, you know, speed, power, all those things are very concerning. And so having an art, that whole premise, they call it the gentle art, and the whole premise is to have the ability to defend yourself by using techniques, tactics, procedures, things that are science-based, that are helping you alleviate and negate some of the tools that the other person might have, such as speed, power, and athleticism. And so that is essentially the base premise of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. So it makes it a very effective art. However, it also has to be combined with an ability to protect against strike. Because if you have no ability to protect against strike, or you don't have any takedown capabilities, now you're looking at not being able to impose your will with your jiu-jitsu, because you simply cannot get close enough, or you can't get the person to the ground, or whatever the case may be. And so if you were to look at it from a self-defense perspective, the actual best way to do it is to kind of go the mixed martial art routes, which gives you a comprehension and an understanding of the basic mechanics of stand-up fighting, striking, and then also of the mechanisms that you can use and will use to bring the person where you want to bring them, which is, in the case of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, on the ground, so that you may enact tactics and techniques that you have in the ground fighting realm. And so having the ability to marry up those three things, ability to sustain and survive an assault, an initial onslaught, having the ability to control the fight and bring the fight where you want it, and then impose your will with your technique and your angles and your leverage when on the ground with the person is critical. And so there is no magic pill in all of those things. You just need to put the time in, and you need to be acquainted to a reasonable level so that you may perform under stress.
Well, it's an important thing that you bring up too, because a lot of these situations are very volatile, and the average person who may not even been in a fight before, may have never been in a violent encounter, it's a real different thing when you're in that moment, and it's, you know, your adrenaline is going, and it's a, you know, for a lot of people, very frightening. So even the ability to try to stay calm in these situations are very helpful and stuff, so that the training for that is important, right? And I even look at it as just a confident booster. If you take someone, even regardless of the martial arts they choose, by them dedicating themselves and they're getting more physical fit, confidence goes up. They may not, just this for that alone, they, as we were talking about, won't appear to be an ideal, you know, victim as much as, say, someone who doesn't have that training and have that ability to kind of stay calm under a very scary situation. Let's talk about the teen violence, because that's something that does concern me, and I do see that this has seen something that's on the rise. It seems like teens are more violent. And what's scary with them is that they do swarming attacks. They use knives. They use bear spray. And they do these horrible coordinated attacks on their victim, regardless if they're male or female, which is really, really disturbing. It's almost something like out of Lord of the Flies or something. What's your thoughts on this phenomenon?
Yeah, I mean, there is some empirical data that's being collected as we speak, and I can't source it right now, but I'm sure if your listeners are listening to this, they'll be able to kind of look it up. But there is some empirical evidence suggesting that the brain size of the current teenagers have actually shrunk. And it's taken, and one of the part of the brain that's actually shrunk is the part that's responsible for empathy. So I don't know if it's the prefrontal cortex, or I believe it might be. And then so they would be resorting more to the monkey brain or the amygdala to basically respond to certain stimuli. It sounds like an innocuous thing, but think about taking empathy off humans. Like, I can't think of anything more catastrophic than that. I mean, if you don't have that and you're dehumanizing humans, I mean, the sky's the limit on what it is that you're willing and able and capable of doing to other people. And so I wouldn't be surprised if that's the case on account of electronics and having your entire world and enthralled in it, having such a polarizing social media landscape, and having some such political division and whatever. So all those things are feeding into some of the things that might be compounded by the fact that there are some physiological changes associated with all the things that we're living with nowadays. So it seems as though they have the ability, experts have the ability to kind of put their fingers on some of the main contributors. And that's both concerning and elating at the same time, because if we can point a finger on it, then can we do something to you know, turn this around? And the answer generally is yes, but it has to be identified first. So I would say that with all that and the desensitization to violence perpetrated by, you know, video games and trust me, I played video games, and video games don't make killers. But if people have propensity for certain violent crimes and they're spending their entire time being rewarded whether it's on a consumatory, you know, reward system or some other types of reward as a result of their actions, such as kicking an old lady in the head in some video games they're playing, then it reinforces some key and very terrifying behaviors. And so again, this is for a long-winded, people are much smarter than me also, but at the end of the day, we know that there is contributing factors, several of them, and all of them are in piece and parcel responsible for what we are seeing today.
Yeah, it's quite frightening and stuff. You know, I have a stepson who's 22, and you know, he had a huge, you know, I'm saying he's not a violent kid or anything like that, but I'm just saying he had this massive big screen TV, you know, playing Call of Duty full blast and just, you know, for him, he's fine. He's playing a game, but for some kid, maybe a little not wired the right way. And he's just in this submersive into this violent world, being around teenagers. So they're doing a lot more drugs, ping like it's going out of style, and popping this and popping that, drinking energy drinks and monsters and things like that. So very different. They're jacked up stuff. And then, you know, again, we're not talking about, you know, when I was 14, I probably didn't have the most common sense either. But the level of violence is on a different level. It's just it's quite frightening, and I hopefully that's a trend that will go down, because it's pretty ugly, and even for them too, like we're saying before, they don't understand that you're going out committing violence to people, you're going to run into a dog way more vicious than you, and it's just a matter of time. And these 14-year-old kids without their bear spray won't have a chance. And honestly, it's almost like you know, Lord help them if they ever run into a real wolf. You know, it's a troubling time for parents, right? So, yeah. So hopefully, you know, things will change. So for teenagers, I think, you know, in my opinion, it'd be great for teenagers to go into martial arts and stuff like that. Do you have a lot of teen programs, things like that at your studio?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And teenagers, I would say, is probably our biggest demographics. But it seems to be consistent across the Lower Mainland. The majority of studios have, you know, oodles of teenagers that are out there doing the thing. So, which is good news. You know, but the entire conversation here, it kind of, brings up another point, which is the age of criminal responsibility, right? Like, right. And it's so interesting how the United Nations, despite having conversation with states and key players and people within the UNs, you know, talk about or trying to establish a reasonableness in terms of age of criminal responsibility. Yet here we are, you have places like Switzerland that I think is 6 years old or something like that. And then you have other places where it's 18, right? So, the spectrum goes anywhere from 5 to literally 20, you know, in the world, age of criminal responsibility. Yet we know for a fact, medically speaking and physiologically speaking, that the brain isn't fully developed until the mid-20s. And so having the ability and the capacity to sort of have consequential thinking with respect to the actions that you are taking is coming later in age. And so those are all things that we need to kind of be looking at also from a societal standpoint.
Yeah, it is. It's very troubling because, again, it's like, what does the future hold for them, right? And even for our society, are they going to get more violent as they get older? Or is this like, unfortunately, it's like a really terrible trend. I hope it's a terrible trend. I hope it doesn't, it's not something that's going to continue and getting worse. You know, wishful thinking, but, you know, one can hope, right? Let's talk about then, we're going back to Vancouver. So the Vancouver Dying documentary, multiple things going on with them, you know, from mental illness, drug addiction, and homelessness. How do we get these people so where they're off the street getting the proper help? In my opinion, them being treated in a kind of like in an open air psychiatric kind of facility with the public, to, in my opinion, doesn't work.
You know, I don't know what the answer to this is. I mean, I'm sure it's a multi-pronged answer, and I'm sure it's way above my pay grade or even, you know, to a certain extent, intellectual capacity. But I think evidently what needs to happen. So if you look at the base model for managing the drug sort of pandemics in Vancouver, had been established initially on four different pillars.
Right.
Out of those four pillars, three were not used at all. So all that was, the entire work was done on one of the four pillars, which was the harm reduction pillar, right?
Right.
And harm reduction, it only offers so much if you refuse to touch the rest of it. And so it's not so much that the academic precedent that was sort of the solutions that were worked out by academics before in relation to the drug crisis in Vancouver wasn't adequate, is that the application of it wasn't, right? And so it's not to say that the plan wasn't good, but the interpretation and enacting of that plan was erroneous. So the question now is, we have new leadership coming into the city. They will have to look at the evidence critically and not worry so much about sort of the narrative, polarizing narratives that are going around from one side or the other, and have that measured approach to problem solving this, but also be very honest with what's actually occurring. You can't sugarcoat things and then try to address them. You need to expose things so that you may address them. So expose them and don't worry so much about shaming this and that and this other person. Focus more on how do we address this? Stop being a victim of your circumstances. We have a drug problem. Drugs isn't good. It's not about shaming or not shaming. It's about the people that are actually doing it and that are addicted, or lives are completely at the mercy of those substances.
Yeah.
It's almost like in the past they've been forgotten about, so to speak, is what your predicament is, and you'll never get out of it. So let's just make sure that we don't shame them, you know, instead of like, hey man, you can do a lot better for yourself, and you can have a lot better than what you have currently. And those are some of the ways that we can do this. But as long as we are catering to a sense of controlling the optics, if I can sort of phrase it this way, it's not going to work. In order for us to change things, we need to address things, and we need to address all their seriousness.
As far as like the criminal aspects of drugs, you know, the trafficking, the exporters, the, you know, the smugglers and that kind of stuff. But I'm talking, you know, for on the end user. How many of it would you say in your career as a police officer, when you get into these volatile situations where the person was either under the influence of alcohol or drugs, like, would you say it was a pretty high percentage?
Oh yeah, it was at least 95%.
Wow, unbelievable. Yeah, I thought it would be high. I was in my head, I was actually guessing about 50%. So that's incredible. The job, it seems to have like so many nuances that are not really in the, I guess, in the definition of the handbook of what a police officer is. Where do you go from there, right? If you can't even get to the point where you're saying like, hey, this person was drunk and did all this violence and therefore they shouldn't be removed off the street. And then you have these people that kind of intervene on their behalf. Well, it's not their fault. They have this, they have that. You know, it's a strange situation we find ourselves in. It really is. It is. And then it blurs the lines. And then again, it just keeps the problem to where it is. And if anything, it's grown worse, right? I've been aware of the downtown east side for about 30 years. I've been working in close proximity, even had friends that ended up there. It is beyond worse than I've ever seen now. It's at the end of the day, if people are, it doesn't matter if they're in poverty or whatever they are in, they deserve a life with dignity and a life that they should be able to get out of it if they want to. And it seems like for whatever it is, it seems like they're trapped in this horrible cycle, this cycle that just keeps continuing. So here we are, right?
Mm-hmm.
So why don't you tell people what you're currently doing? You have a new business now. You're mm-hmm. retired. You're not RCMP anymore. So what do you do now?
Yeah, I do a variety of different things, but consulting, security or otherwise. I do performance coaching. So this is primarily, I would say, life coaching, you know, like goal set and increasing performance in whatever field of endeavor you're in. So I do a lot of one-on-one Zoom type meetings and coaching on that. Do them in person also. I do overseas work, again, in the security field primarily, and I would say dangerous areas. I currently am doing my master's in global counterterrorism, so I'm also in school at the moment, which is taking a lot of time, taking a lot of my time. And what else I got going on? I'm doing content creation and documentaries style projects that I have going on, and so I have a book I'm writing on, that I'm working on, that may end up being motivational videos. We don't know yet. It might actually, you know, go from being a book to being another medium by which we're going to deliver our material. I do resilience training. I do leadership training with law enforcement and non-law enforcement agencies, and bring my experience to bear in some of those circles. So yeah, so that's essentially what I'm doing, what I have been doing for 2 years.
What's the name of your business?
Raven Strategic.
And how do one, if they're listening, how do they get in touch with you if they wanted to learn Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, mindset, or any of the other many things that you offer?
Yeah, like Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, they can go straight to the Ascension Martial Arts website and send us an email, and we'll set up initial, you know, consultation where they can come, and we're doing an introduction to Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu if they've never seen it. If they've done it before and they want to just start, they can just send us a message and we can make that happen. When it comes to the performance coaching side and anything related to me, my Instagram is probably the best way to do it. My Instagram, I'm sure you'll have linked to your to the podcast here. Yes. But
well, I really appreciate you taking the time. Honestly, it's an honor to interview you, and I want to thank you for your 20-year service, and I really appreciate everything that you've done, and really done a lot of stuff, and just really an incredible story. So thank you so much for coming on Vancouver True Crime.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, man.
All right. You take care. You have a wonderful day.
Sounds good. You too, bud.